The following podcast was recorded through a sciency wormhole. Portions were recorded nearly a month ago. You'll know the portions that weren't, because we will say they weren't during those portions. Coming up, where did we go anyway? News from last month, and we talked to video game expert Chris Sullentrop. It's Tuesday, the best day of the week. I'm Steve Tushankel, and you're listening to the New England Tech Podcast. The New England Tech Podcast is brought to you by Hammerhead Content Management Solutions for media organizations and content creators. You love to write, so why do you hate to publish? Visit us at hammerheadcms.com. And by Purolator Courier. Purolator Courier, you may not be sure how to pronounce it or what it does, but whatever, use it anyway. Music in this show is by Kurt Baker, Lame Drivers, Monkey Mind, The Pharaohs, and The Barracudas. So our last show was several weeks ago. And ever since then, a lot of people have been contacting me and saying, Steve, where's the show? Where's the podcast? We live and die by the New England Tech Podcast. We need the show. Where is it? Well, I'll tell you, because it's a cautionary tale about technology. Now, when I started the New England Tech Podcast, I promised that we would be here every Tuesday with news, views, interviews, other things that rhyme with views. And we've stuck to that, but several weeks ago, I was conducting an interview with Chris Sullentrop, a video game expert. He is a journalist who writes about, among other things, video games. And during the interview, it simply stopped working. Everything disconnected. Everything seemed to crash. And when I tried to reconnect with Chris, I found that it wasn't possible to do so. I found that not only was my microphone not picking up sound, but my computer would not, in fact, play sound. So that's what happened. I ended up sending the computer back to the manufacturer, who repaired a broken sound card and sent it back to me. But that took a while, and in the interim, I did not have the required equipment to produce a podcast. Now, what happened? What exactly happened? You already heard the sound card broke, right? But why? Why did the sound card break? This is a fairly new computer, by the way. I've only had this for a couple months. I actually purchased this computer specifically to do podcasts, and therein lies the problem. I wanted to go cheap on this. Now, anyone who knows me and maybe even has listened to this podcast and heard me comment on expensive tech items versus affordable tech items knows that I am an advocate of affordable technology. I think that there's a lot of technology out there that, quite frankly, is overpriced. I think you don't have to pay that much to enjoy great technology. A lot of smartphones, for example, are well overpriced. I have one that works reasonably well, and you wouldn't even believe how little I paid for it. But there are limits to how little you can pay. Now, I needed a Windows laptop to do my podcast. Could have gotten a Mac laptop too, but that's very, very expensive. My typical computer that I use is a Chromebook. Now, Chromebooks are not the most used type of laptop out there. You may not even really know what a Chromebook is, right? I mean, you probably heard of it, but you may not actually know what it is. It's a scaled-down laptop. They tend to be very affordable. They run an operating system based on the Chrome web browser. They do not, with some exceptions, which I won't get into right now, but they do not, in general, run a full operating system and therefore cannot install applications. And that means you can't install any of the applications that one would typically use to record a podcast. So, I needed another computer that could record a podcast, and it turned out to be a $250 Asus laptop that I purchased from Best Buy. Now, initially I tried Staples, by the way. Initially I tried buying a laptop at Staples, but the laptop I bought from Staples didn't even work when I pulled it out of the box. It actually was actually slowing down my internet connection, believe it or not. I'd never seen anything like it before. I would turn it on, I would connect it to Wi-Fi, and not only would the computer run at a crawl when accessing the internet, but every single other internet-connected device that I had would also run at a crawl. It was really the darndest thing. And Staples refused to believe me. They refused to believe that there was an issue with the computer. They thought that maybe I had too many devices connected to the internet. Now, here's the thing about that. First of all, there shouldn't really be a limit as to how many devices you have connected to the internet. There is a limit. There is a technical limit depending on what type of equipment you have, but you really, nobody should reach that limit. Will devices run slower if you have more of them connected? Absolutely, yes. But it shouldn't go from fast to non-existent. It should go from fast to a little less fast. Then you connect one more and it's still a little less fast until you get to non-existent. But by that point, you would have known something was wrong, right? So Staples refused to believe me that something about the hardware of this computer was killing my internet connection throughout the house. So I simply returned it, went to Best Buy, bought another cheap computer, and I bought it specifically for its high sound quality, but it was nonetheless very cheap. You should see this thing, by the way. It's just a plastic shell. Many computers are plastic shells, but with this one, you really know it's a plastic shell. So I bought this $250 laptop, and turns out its excellent sound caused the sound card to blow out within 6 or so weeks of me purchasing it. So that is what happened. Let this be a lesson to you. Now, always read reviews. I read reviews of this laptop before I bought it. The reviews seemed good, right? So the reviews aren't always going to tell you, but, you know, maybe be a little smarter about it. And I'm not preaching here because I've made these mistakes, as you've heard me talk about today. And I will make these mistakes again. That's the truth. I believe in value so much that I will absolutely make these same mistakes again because I think in the long run you benefit, right? I could be down thousands upon thousands upon thousands of dollars if I didn't think like this. And every once in a while you have a little issue, but be careful is what I have to say to you. Be careful and think about the trade-offs. You know, there's a trade-off for everything and there's a trade-off in this too. It's a risk-reward situation. When you buy a $250 laptop, you are taking a risk. Now, when you buy cheap electronics, sometimes, and I would argue most of the time, that risk is going to pay off. Right, depending on what the electronics are, depending on whether they're well-reviewed. But occasionally, it's not going to pay off. And this time, it didn't pay off. But I'm back for the time being until this happens again. Remember the top of the show when I said portions would be pre-recorded? Well, the news is one of those portions. But if you haven't heard about it, it's new to you and it's news to you. So let's go and see what's in the news. Two stories of great local import to the people of New England that I did not want to miss covering on the podcast this week. First off, the storied and longstanding Yankees-Red Sox rivalry, which everyone here in New England feels very, very passionately about, has entered the digital age. Investigators for Major League Baseball now believe that the Red Sox have been using an Apple Watch to steal signs and report those signs back to their players. If you're not up on the details of baseball, let me explain to you what this means for a moment. Baseball is a game of strategy, and it is a game of signs, hand signals, and similar signals that coaches and managers and players on the field use to communicate things to each other. They can't call a play out loud like happens in football because then the other team would be alerted to it. So instead, they do hand signals. They touch their shoulders or they touch their knees or they put up two fingers or one finger. It happens in various situations. This is what signs are in baseball. Now, as long as
there have been signs in baseball. There have been attempts to steal signs. And many players and coaches and managers are known as expert sign stealers. It's something that everybody wants to do, and it's okay. It's actually not considered cheating. If you are able to steal a sign, Major League Baseball officially says, go ahead, steal that sign. But what you cannot do is use technology to steal the signs, and that seems to be what the Red Sox have been doing. Now, I personally think, and I'm going to editorialize here a little bit on the state of sports journalism in our country. I personally think that reporting on this issue, when it broke this past week, was pretty bad. I read a number of articles about this and could not figure out exactly what happened. All I heard was Apple Watch used to steal signs. Apple Watch used to steal signs. Well, how? Was it a Siri type of thing? Is Siri capable of stealing signs and conveying it? I don't know. So I did a little more research on this. I did some pretty extensive research. And this seems to be what happened. And I want to emphasize the word seems. I don't want to be sued by libel or for libel by the Boston Red Sox or anything like that. Perish the thought. That would be horrifying. Nobody would ever listen to my podcast again if the Boston Red Sox sued me for libel here in New England. That is for sure. But this is what appears to have occurred. Some personnel in the clubhouse of the Boston Red Sox during a game were watching a video feed of the game. They could then see the signs that the Yankees were sending each other, and they used an Apple Watch to transmit what they found to somebody in the dugout. That, I believe, was a trainer in the dugout, would then convey that sign via the traditional means of hand signals to the second baseman, who would then convey those signals to the batter. And this sounds complex, but it all took place in mere seconds. And then the Red Sox batter, whoever it was able to figure out what the Yankees' next pitch was supposed to be and would then be better equipped to hit that pitch. So, you just heard a better explanation of what happened than you will get in 99% of the reporting about this out there. That's why you got to listen to the New England Tech Podcast, folks. I love saying folks. That's why you got to do it, folks, right? Don't you sound authoritative when you say folks? That's why you have to listen to this. But you're going to see this happen more and more and more, right? You've already been seeing technology used to cheat in sports in various ways. That doesn't even have to mean digital technology, as we refer to it here. You know, think of all the issues with doping and various performance-enhancing drugs that have occurred in sports in general, particularly in the last 20 or so years. But, where the technology exists, people will always try to use to get a leg up. That's true in sports. That's true everywhere. So expect to see more of this. And good luck to our beloved Boston Red Sox as they fight this scurrilous charge. Next, is Amazon moving to New England? Well, that's a little bit of a dishonest tease on my part because Amazon has not indicated that they're moving to England. However, the behemoth Seattle-based e-retailer and much more, as we talked about in the podcast last week, they're well beyond e-retail now. They're moving into the brick-and-mortar world like crazy. But due to their expansion, they have stated that Seattle is no longer enough for them as a headquarters. Now, they're going to stay in Seattle, but they are looking to open a headquarters somewhere else in the United States. I'm not sure they actually specify the United States, truth be told, but let's just assume the United States for the time being. They're looking to open a second headquarters that will be equal to the Seattle headquarters. So basically, they will have dual headquarters. Now, whenever something like this happens, and giant company talks about relocating, you have to think about Boston, right? Boston is always in the game. Boston, about a year or two ago, landed General Electric, GE, as they relocated to Connecticut. They are a big player. The economy is booming. They've got resources. They've got pretty much everything a major corporation could want. Now, also, when GE decided to relocate their headquarters, Rhode Island bid on the headquarters and made it surprisingly far. I was really, really proud as a Rhode Island resident myself that Rhode Island made it to the last round in the GE relocation. And though we were not awarded the headquarters, as nobody really expected us to be to, it says it to be, it said something that we made it to that stage of the game. And in fact, GE was so impressed that it agreed to open an office after the fact and add a bunch of jobs in Rhode Island, even though it wasn't the headquarters. So Rhode Island has already announced that they are bidding for the new Amazon co-headquarters. And Boston is certainly in the mix as well. Now, unlike the GE situation, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh has expressed some public skepticism about this. He says that he is not going to get into a bidding war over Amazon. And one would certainly expect that a bidding war is just what Amazon wants by announcing that, you know, we're looking for a headquarters somewhere, cities everywhere, metro areas everywhere. Come kowtow to us, give us all the tax breaks. Marty Walsh, the mayor, says that's not happening in Boston. But even though he says that, you still have to think Boston is a player. We've talked so much in this podcast about how the tech scene is booming in Boston. And Rhode Island, let's see how far they can get. I certainly don't expect them to be the new Seattle, right? The new secondary headquarters for Amazon. But don't count Rhodey out. It worked out last time, and this could be a gateway, just like GE, to Amazon greatly expanding operations in the Ocean State.
Promise that you like me, 'cause it could go downhill.
Reddit is a bit of a dirty word in some circles. It is a website that raises a lot of eyebrows when people talk about it. It is also phenomenally popular. You may not realize this if you're not a user yourself, but Reddit is, in fact, the eighth most popular website in the entire world. In the world. That means Chinese search engines that you've never heard of, serving more than a billion people. All those sites are in the mix when we talk about the most popular sites in the world. Reddit is number eight. That is a huge accomplishment for a site that, frankly, seems a little bit low rent if you use it. The user experience is not terribly sophisticated, but it works. It works. Now, I've been getting a little more into Reddit lately, and I'll tell you how I use it. I use it to follow discussions on subjects I'm interested in, such as things in the technology world, such as streaming television, things like that. I also use it just to read about some interesting stuff. There's a subreddit, and I'll tell you what that is in a moment, called Ask Reddit, where people ask questions of their fellow users every day, and people just have to come in and answer them. You see some really interesting answers. People pose interesting questions, and they get interesting answers in return. Now, a subreddit is a section of Reddit that anyone can create. Reddit does not have a staff on high that says these are going to be the topics that are discussed on Reddit. These are the subreddits that exist. No, people create those. And some of them are, some of them don't have anyone coming in, but others are hugely, hugely popular. The way Reddit works is people post links to things they find interesting, or they just post text that they write themselves, and the Reddit users upvote those contributions, right? So if you like something, if you like what you see, you click the up arrow, and if enough people do that, then it gets elevated on the homepage of Reddit all. And that also works within a subreddit, right? Even within the context of a single subreddit, say the Reddit for Netflix, for example, one that I frequent, the topics that get the most upvotes land higher on the page. And the topics that get downvotes, because they're not high-quality topics, they get buried. So you never really see them. And that's the idea of Reddit. It's pretty simple, right? Doesn't seem like it'd be so offensive, but the idea that people can create whatever they want and pretty much say whatever they want, these subreddits are self-moderated, right? They have moderators appointed, But those moderators come from within that community. So the fact that these things are true allows for very controversial subreddits. Anyone who's been following the news lately has heard about the uptick in racism and bigotry and violence, political violence in America today. And a lot of that can be tied back to Reddit. A lot of these communities really coalesce on Reddit. These people are able to find each other. They're able to get together. So whereas, you know, 15, 20 years ago, if you were, you know, a huge racist, you may have had, depending on where you lived and who you associated with, limited resources to connect to with other racists. Today, anyone can do it, and they can become more racist as a result of that. That's just the way it works. So Reddit gets a bad reputation. A lot of people associated with these controversial communities that exist. And by the way, Reddit has shut down some of the most controversial ones. The ones that are potentially breaking the law, the ones that are threatening real people, the ones that are exposing the personal information of real people, those have been shut down. But there are others that still exist that avoid explicit lawbreaking. And those have continued on as influential communities in very, very controversial movements. So that's what people really think of when they think of Reddit very often. However, from the beginning, from the first time I was involved in the internet in the mid-90s, the first time I really got into the internet, I fell a little bit in love with the idea of the internet as this democratization of conversation, of everybody being able to have a conversation about anything, from about whatever they want, from wherever they want. It's a great thing, and it's a scary thing, and it's a bad thing all at the same time. Back in the mid-90s, I was very wine and roses, and I was very much optimistic about the whole social experiment of this. I was an early believer in the idea that this would change the game in terms of what we could discuss. And I probably naively believe that society would be the better for it. Now, more than 20 years later, it seems like society is not the better for it. It seems that a lack of moderation has emerged from this concept of anybody being able to discuss any topic with anyone else. So it's a problem, but it's not new. And Reddit didn't invent this problem. Reddit is just the latest popular vehicle for it. You know, back then, back in the mid-90s, I used to be on Usenet newsgroups. And these same sorts of discussions, actually even more unregulated than with Reddit, because nobody owned Usenet newsgroups, but these same discussions happened there. And that was the Wild West. Usenet newsgroups were also not user-friendly to most people. They were inaccessible to the great majority of the population. Reddit, in today's internet age, where everybody's familiar with the web and how it works, anyone can pretty much get on it and use it. And it's simple. It's simple to do. So I think that's why people tear their hair out about Reddit in a way that they didn't all these years about Usenet newsgroups and about any other services, websites, whatever, that have existed in the years since. So if you haven't checked out Reddit, the great thing about it is there's something on it for you, right? There is something on it for you. Discussion can be juvenile in some subreddits, but there are others where it would surprise you to know that the discourse is quite high. For example, politics is a big interest of mine. The politics subreddit, you think that would be awful? It's not. It's actually really good with some intelligent discussion and intelligent people, and it very, very rarely devolves into confrontation or, just bigotry or any of the negative things that we have about politics these days. So Reddit is people, and people are Reddit. It can be good. It can be bad. There's always a desire to blame the medium. But of course, the message is always what's really at issue. Reddit is a medium, and I'm not going to answer the question right now. That'd be a much longer discussion. That would be a giant book on how we can create a better message, how we can encourage people to share better messages. But Reddit is going to be a container. It's going to be a home for all the discussion that happens, whether good or bad, and until something better comes along, it's going to be here for a while.
Our guest on the podcast this week is video game authority. Can I say authority?
Oh, I mean, I think I'm a real authority on the subject, yes.
Well, that's good to know. Wouldn't have had you on otherwise. Chris Sullentrop of East Greenwich, Rhode Island, lives right here in the same town as I do. And full disclosure, I actually have two full disclosures. Last time we tried this, I had one, which is that I have done consulting work for you before. And you said at the time that that didn't really count because you hadn't paid me. And I guess you sort of still haven't paid me because we had check issues.
I tried. That makes it sound like it bounced. But yeah, I filled it out incorrectly, which is close to the same thing.
Yes, I do not want to libel you at all on this podcast. But the other full disclosure is that last time we tried to do this interview, you completely blew out my sound card, leading to my nearly month-long podcast hiatus. Not your fault. It was the fault of my $250 computer. But... just wanted to say that this is not the first time that we've done this.
So buckle your seatbelts.
We'll see what happens. But Chris, like I said, thanks a lot for being here. I want to talk to you about your video game podcast, Shall We Play a Game? Can you tell me a little bit about what that is and how long you've been doing it?
Yeah, shockingly, when I think about it, I've been doing it for a couple years now. We've done 111 episodes. Started it with J.J. Sutherland, a former National Public Radio producer and correspondent who I met a decade or more ago when I was at Slate Magazine. He's produced and worked for all the shows you've heard of, you know, Morning Edition, All Things Considered, all that kind of stuff. And now works for, I'm forgetting the name of his company. You know the name of his company.
Some or other. I know he's a scrum master.
That's right. He works for Scrum. And so, but he also plays video games and loves them as I do. And I used to be the video game critic for the New York Times. And when the New York Times eliminated that position, I was really into podcasts. I guess it was the summer of Serial. That was right before Serial. We got this started before Serial, but still there was a lot of podcast fervor in the air. And there wasn't one that there were some that I really, loved. But there was none that did what I wanted to do with this show, which was something short that respects your time, that was sort of PG rated, that you could listen to in the car with your kids, but that also, had the journalistic and production values of NPR and The Times and other things like that. And I'm not saying it's a video game chat show. Don't get me wrong, but we try to, you know, do as good a job as we can with it.
You promote it as being a video game podcast for adults as well. That doesn't mean there's adult content. You can still listen with your kids, but it's got a little older of a focus than other video game podcasts. Would you say that?
Yeah, we're both parents. So we're not really talking a lot about, you know, playing with our daughters. I have two daughters. He has one. All three of them are under the age of 10. But the fact that we've both played games for, you know, 30 years or more, and gives us a different perspective than the enthusiast 25-year-old. It's not adult from the perspective of, but one of our listeners is like, finally, a video game podcast for grownups. And so I've sort of latched on to that tagline.
So I'm really interested in the dichotomy between the way people used to view video games as being purely for kids, right? Certainly when I was a kid in the 80s, you know, with an NES playing video games, that's how all adults perceived it. There may have been some adults out there who, you know, secretly went downstairs and played their kids' systems, played their games, but everyone knew video games were for kids back then. And all these years later, video games have really extended their reach to a much wider set of demographic groups, both age groups and other demographic groups as well. What led to that transition, do you think?
Well, a few things. First of all, I just quibble a little bit with the premise. You're right that in the 80s, video games are for kids. But in the 70s, video games are for grownups. In the 70s, video games are for sophisticates.
Yeah, I wasn't around, so I forgot that part.
The New York Times, I mean, I wasn't around for this either, but the New York Times magazine does a story in the early 70s about what it calls, it was like the thinking man's pinball or something like that. But it was
flaming bars, right?
Trying to figure out what is this new machine, the arcade game that is popping up in New York bars, in Manhattan bars, and compares the arcade game, says, you know, pinball is lowbrow. Pinball is for truck drivers, but arcade games, these new electronic pinball machines were for urban sophisticates. And that sort of continues up through the 83 crash. So in 83, the video game industry in the United States crashes and almost disappears from the face of the earth. And up until that point, at least the Times, and according to the archival research I've done at the paper, takes video games incredibly seriously as an emerging art form and as a popular form of entertainment for adults. Then after that, it gets regarded as a sort of fad. It was a fad. It's over. And then when Nintendo comes back in 85 and re-enters the United States with a Nintendo Entertainment System and has a strategy of branding video games because video games have this stench of a fad about them, rebrands games as a toy and a toy for kids. Mm-hmm. And specifically sort of has to position them as these aren't video games. This is a toy you can buy. It's got a gun. It's got a little robot. And that's what starts the rebranding of games as being for children. And you're right. Then you go through the 90s when games are extreme and they're like Mountain Dew or something, right? And you have the rise of Grand Theft Auto, which is an extraordinary game, but still the PlayStation and Sega Genesis are marketing themselves as these sort of like aggressively teenage boy macho devices. Xbox does the same thing. But over the past 10 years, with the rise of the Wii, the rise of the iPhone, the rise of Steam, the downloadable the video game platform owned by Valve, a company in Redmond, Washington, the rise of indie games. You've just had this Cambrian explosion of the type and form of games, and that's meant that there are all kinds of new players. I mean, it's still everyone plays video games, but the funny thing about it is not everyone will admit it. It's still considered a sort of like furtive, secretive hobby that people, you know, do, as you say, do in their basements and don't tell anyone or gasp do on the toilet or something like that. So there's definitely the feeling that it's a private habit that's not very respectable.
Well, I've never played a video game on the toilet in my life. I have no idea what you're talking about. So what, basically, what do you think is happening with video games now? So you've gone through that whole progression of the history of video games, which was really, really interesting and really insightful. What's changing in video games now? I mean, basically a big part of what you're doing is following these trends. So I'm curious as to where you think these trends are leading. What's changing?
Yeah, I don't know where we go, right? I'll never make predictions because you're always wrong, mm-hmm. although predictions are fun. But obviously there's a lot of exciting things going on in games right now. You have all the experimentation with virtual reality that's going on. You have all the augmented reality stuff from Pokemon Go to, Star Wars had a kind of augmented reality game a month or two ago on the phone. You have the Nintendo Switch, which is sort of bringing together the idea of eliminating the divide between a handheld device and a console device that has been, I think, the best-selling console in the United States for four of the last 6 months. PlayStation 4 is a huge success. Xbox is struggling a little bit, but Microsoft has lots of money and, is trying to bring PC and console gaming together in interesting ways. You still have all kinds of experimentation with narrative, but then you also have like the rise of these games that are designed to be kind of like the only game you ever play, you know, whether it's Overwatch by Blizzard or the MOBAs like Dota 2, which are these multi player online battle arenas that are the equivalent of sports, right? That like rather than treating a game like a book or a movie where you'd go through a dozen in a year or whatever, these companies want to make these games that are so big that you're going to spend, you know, 2 years just sort of living there and doing nothing but that. And so those live alongside these smaller games that you pay a dollar for that are a cool indie experience, or you pay 10 or 10 bucks and last a couple hours. And so who knows where it's going to go, but it's sort of going in all directions all the time.
Seems to me like this is the time when video games are going in the most directions. I can't think of a time in the past. I'm not a video game historian like yourself, but I can't think of a time when the landscape has ever been so fragmented, in that so many different companies are working on so many different things, and who knows where this could end up. Have you seen a time like this before, or is this really the point in our history where there's the most uncertainty about the future?
I mean, I think it's the most interesting time to be a player, right? Just because there's the most, you're saying, there's more going on than ever before. It's still, you know, mildly frustrating that if you want to know everything there is to know about video games, if you're someone who loves them like I do, you have to have like 5 devices and, multiple VR headsets. And, you know, it's still got that sort of bar to entry that being a book lover or a movie lover doesn't have. You know, you don't need to own a different VCR, I'm dating myself. You don't need to own a different Blu-ray player to watch, you know, the movies from Sony and the movies from Fox and the movies from Warner Brothers. And, so you can just buy one. And that's, you know, yes, that's true on a PC. There's some, platform standardization. But lots of games are only on certain consoles, only on a PlayStation, only on an Xbox, less so on an Xbox these days, but only on a Nintendo device, only on a phone, whatever. But I don't think there's ever been a better or more interesting time to be a video game player.
So considering that so many people are playing video games today, you said earlier that pretty much everybody plays video games now of various types. Why is there still that stigma that you alluded to?
It's a good question. I mean, some of it relates to the obvious juvenilia that a lot of, you know, there are lots of juvenile games, right? I mean,
there are a lot of juvenile movies too, right? But you don't see stigma.
Correct.
About going to the movies.
No, I know. Yeah, American Pie, the movie American Pie didn't make everybody think, oh, gosh, these movies are just for, teenage boys. So some of it relates to the form's history. Some of it relates to a discomfort we have as a culture with play, right? Play is juvenile fundamentally. And so it's fundamentally unserious on some level. Some of it, I think, relates to the print-pocalypse we've had in journalism. That means that this amazingly interesting decade has been less examined than by mainstream journalists than the previous ages mm-hmm. of video games were. Just because journalism, newspapers, and elsewhere, magazines are just sort of fortifying their positions, right? They're not doing as much expansion as they did in the 80s and 90s. And I think the Times would still have vibrant video game coverage that they had for many years, for decades. If the paper's not broke, but it's facing financial challenges that it wasn't facing.
Yes, the failing New York Times.
And so, but it's hard for me to know because I find this stuff so interesting. But it's definitely true that, like, yes, everyone plays video games. It's also true that, like, to become deeply knowledgeable about them requires an amount of work that isn't required to, like, know. They're so big. The end of the year rewards are like, have you played these 4 games that each take 20 or 30 hours to play? You know, watching it's more like if the Emmys were all about like total TV series blocks, like at the Emmys every year was like, have you watched the entire series run of Game of Thrones, The Wire, The Sopranos, you know, and I don't know, whatever else. And so there is an investment of time that's involved. I also think it's difficult to overstate the effect that Gamergate had on solidifying people's opinions. Like, games were moving in a really interesting direction. They were starting to get taken more seriously by the culture, by the people who run newspapers and magazines and broadcast networks in New York City mostly. And then this horrific harassment campaign that, you know, predated all the tactics we now see in the, you know, in the political media with fake news and bots and doxing and all that stuff. It was a sort of trial run for all those things. But because if video games sort of crawl out of their box and then they, something like that happens, and people who are inclined to say, oh, this is something I don't need to worry about because it's just what I thought it was. I think that Gamergate caused that reaction in a lot of people in important places in our cultural institutions.
Probably a lot of people listening don't know what Gamergate was, didn't hear about it. Can you tell us a little bit about how that started and what exactly it consisted of?
Yeah, Gamergate, which is a difficult thing to describe, in short form, was a, you know, leaderless online movement spawned out of a 4chan poster. A man wrote a sort of like 12-page screed about his game developer girlfriend, which then led an online mob to begin to harass her for what they saw as her nefarious ways. And they then concocted a sort of cover story involving putatively ethical violations among certain game journalists, of which none were ever really found, but that was the rallying cry. But anyway, it was really and then there was a larger movement that they would more be openly admitted, saying they were opposed to sort of like people politicizing video games, by which they meant putting liberal politics into their video games, right? Mm-hmm. So, but even that, which is a subject you could actually have a conversation about, I think becomes irrelevant when the tactics involved, you know, driving women from their homes, game developer women's, YouTube critics of video games. And so it was an ugly thing.
But as unfortunate as this all is, it's also really interesting because it shows how important video games are in our culture in general as sort of a leading indicator of other trends, right? You said that this was first, before all the fake news that we heard about, before the red pill and all that. I mean, maybe it was concurrent with
the red pill people are the exact same people.
Yeah, right.
Like Milo Yiannopoulos, Mike Cernovich, all those guys who these pro-Trump provocateurs, they all cut their teeth on Gamergate. And if you read Josh Green's book about Steve Bannon, Bannon kind of sees this and knows that he can sort of harness these forces that were obviously vibrant and powerful for his own ends. Anyway, it's definitely interesting.
So before we finish up, because we only have a few minutes left, I definitely need to ask you. So you are an accomplished journalist. You've been a working journalist for probably around 20 years, and you've covered some pretty important and prestigious subjects. I know you've spent a lot of time in the political world. You know, you mentioned Slate, and you continue to do that. You continue to cover politics for the New York Times Magazine and publications like that. What makes you, as someone who has built a very successful career in a very established channel of journalism, what makes you interested in writing and reporting on video games?
A few things. One is my interest in interactive culture more broadly. I've been covering politics and other things for close to 20 years. But like, you know, my first real job in the national media was at Slate, which I started it on like January 2nd or 3rd, 2000. So I got a job there in the fall of 99. It was like the most internet thing you could do. Right. And I spent 5 years there thinking about what does interaction and interactivity and computation and all the things the internet brings to us mean for political journalism, and especially for the kind of political journalism done by small Washington magazines. And that interest is beyond, in addition to the nostalgia I have for playing games when I was a kid, but that interest is part of what brings me to what does interactive culture mean for fiction, for movies, for literature, all of which are things games are experimenting with in really interesting ways. Part of it is just part of the reason you become a journalist is because you like to be on the steep part of the learning curve. And so games are something that's changing and different, and there's always something new to look at. And then it was also like, you know, the New York Times gave me a column to write about video games. they weren't gonna give me a column to write about politics. And so I saw an opportunity where I thought, here's a place where I can maybe climb the ladder a little bit and do something fun and interesting, but also do something maybe nobody else has done before. And that was a draw to me. Whether that turned out to be a wise decision, I think the jury's still out. My friend Tom Bissell, who is a notable novelist and nonfiction journalist, now writes video games for a living. And he used to write a lot of video game criticism. And he warned me, he said, sometimes I think I ruined my career by doing that, because games make children of us all at some level. And I think he's wrong. I mean, he wrote the very best book ever about what it's like to be a video game player called Extra Lives. And he's, now sort of the William Goldman of video games, where he's gone from highbrow, you know, nonfiction writing to game writing, writing actual video games. Video games don't – writing about video games does not pay the way writing about tech or politics or mm-hmm. money or finance. And so you see a lot of very fine writers come into the field and sort of say their piece and then leave after a few years. And so hopefully that won't happen to me. We'll see.
I would love to talk more about that, but I think we're out of time. So, Chris, thanks a lot for joining us on the podcast today.
Listen to Shall We Play a Game? It's almost as good as this podcast.
Following politics for the past year or 4 years or 8 years or even beyond that, you may have noticed a trend, which is that bipartisanship has completely gone out the window in Washington, D.C. I sound like such a hack political podcast host right now. Joe and I, it's a good thing this isn't a political podcast, it's a tech podcast. But the truth of the matter is, everyone agrees there used to be a tradition of bipartisan getting things done in Washington, and there is no longer. It's Democrats against Republicans. Never the twain shall meet. They hate each other. They will not compromise at all or do business with each other. And you can blame who you want for that, but that's the reality. And nobody really disputes that reality, least of all the politicians. So it was certainly a big surprise while we were on break when the U.S. House of Representatives passed a unanimous piece of legislation. How often does that happen anymore? They pass something unanimously. Every single congressman went in and voted for this. And that bill that they voted on was an attempt to speed the adoption of self-driving cars. According to the terms of the new law, automakers now can deploy 25,000 vehicles a year without meeting existing auto safety standards. And over the course of the three following years, they will be able to deploy 100,000 vehicles that are self-driving, self-propelled. This is huge. This is an endorsement by the United States government of self-driving cars. It is an acknowledgement that they are the future of transportation and that they want to do everything they can. Every single congressman wants to do everything he or she can to speed the adoption of self-driving cars. Now, self-driving cars are a very exciting piece of technology. They're also, despite that unanimous vote, a bit of a controversial piece of technology. I'm kind of psyched, but some people are a little skittish, and we'll talk about why on next week's podcast. Well, thanks so much for listening, everyone. How many of you are still there after those unexpected weeks off we had? Hopefully a lot of you. Hopefully a lot of you will listen. I apologize again for buying a $250 computer that broke down. Don't do it. If you want a podcast, don't do it yourself. You will have to suffer the consequences. Well, maybe not. Maybe you'll get luckier than I got. But you may have to suffer the consequences. Again, like I said before, risk and reward, risk and reward. It's all about that. There are no sure things in life, but some things are surer than others. So I thank you all for joining me this week and picking the podcast back up. We will be back next Tuesday with more news, more interviews, more fun, right? I owe you guys some more fun. Let's do it. Thanks a lot, everybody. This is Steve DeShankle. Courage.